Okay, well, what I hope to do tonight is to give you an introduction, for some of you who may not be aware of it, of efforts not only on the idea of open data, but especially what's referred to as linked open data. I always like to start off with quotes. So in this particular quote, it somehow alludes to exactly what Paul was saying. And that is that when we're talking about all the data that we're collecting in science, all the big data issues that you're talking about, in some ways it's changed this idea of what you know. And now it really means how you can take information and know how to use it. And effectively, that's where the title of this comes from. So my concept or my premise is taking information and turning it into knowledge. So everybody knows that the web has just got a tremendous amount of data. An unmanageable amount of data. In fact, some people have suggested that it's already overloaded. It's already too full. It's reached a critical mass. And the bigger issue then is, how do you take all of that data and make sense of it and turn it into knowledge, put it into context? And the example that I like to use for that is that, you know, if you go into something like Google and you say, what is the capital of China? Why does Google return 10,000 answers, at least, more than that? Because there's only one answer to that question. It simply is suggesting that when you make that query, it has no idea what you're talking about. You know, it doesn't understand the context of what your query was. So what we're going to talk about are some of the efforts that really, in some ways, allow you, as it were, to put this data in contact with the hope that in some ways it has a semblance of data, of knowledge. And there's this familiar concept of the data pyramid about, you know, basically then the point at which large amounts of data then gradually turn into meaningful information and then meaningfully turn into knowledge. And I'm even going to address the issue about how you turn knowledge into wisdom. I don't think I'm old enough for that yet. But the question is, how do you take it and turn into something that really, as it were, constitutes context and understanding how these pieces of information fit together, and consequently then how other people can use these pieces of information? So it's not just about extracting knowledge, but it's also about sharing knowledge. Okay? And when you look at the web, you know, typically when we think about the web, you know, you think about the way it's composed. It's being composed of pages and documents. And that seems to be pretty much the quantities that you're dealing with when you're dealing specifically about the web. Clearly, you're able to take pieces of data, such as images and things, and stick them into web pages. And that's one of the rare times that you actually deal with individual entities of data, as opposed to what you create in the case of pages. Now, along comes this idea of mashups, and this is basically talking in that case about the web of data. It's talking about, in some ways, about how can you take data and combine it with other data to create something more interesting. Okay? The idea was good, but the process was pretty clunky. Sometimes you could do it with APIs, but in many cases you relied on people doing what's called screen scraping. In other words, you just kind of take everything off of a page and try to pick out the parts that are interesting, pretty much the same way like search engines do. So that was really sort of the first beginnings, as it were, of thinking about, you know, how do you, can you capture elements of web content in things other than such as pages, and that idea. So when we talk about that, you know, you think about this as sort of the web of documents. That's the old web. the web of documents. And the analogy that you like to think of it as is a global file system or a global library or something of that nature. And so really what could happen is that you could link between them, but in reality, the structure in them was pretty low. Okay? Because of anything could basically be in a web page. So the structure of the content was pretty much dictated by the units of a web page. And the semantics of the content, well, the only way that you could do something like that was implicitly through links. So in other words, you know, clearly you would expect that a page would link to another page simply because those two pages had something in common. And that was the only context that perhaps you could draw between the content that was in those two pages. So that was pretty rough. It was pretty hard to think of that really in a way that constitutes putting something together that really constitutes knowledge. Okay? So the web of documents, the good thing about it was that it was simple. And that's clearly one of the reasons why the web has been so successful. It was loosely structured. You didn't have to do anything like associate data types with links. Links were just links. They just pointed to someplace else. And, you know, you didn't even have backward links. So, you know, you could see where a link went, but it was hard to tell where, if you were on a page, where the link came from. So it really didn't even have bi-directional kinds of connectivity between those pieces of content. And the integration was pretty poor. And that really shows itself in a lot of ways when you look at the kind of ways that you could query it, so you can look at that data. So imagine, as it were, you know, how would I do something like, say, show me all the publications from the HKU PhD students in computer science? Okay, that's a very, everyone understands that, right? Why can't computers understand that? Why can't search engines understand a simple query like that? Or what papers have I written with colleagues outside of the United States? Now you can clearly try to come up with some clever advanced search statement in Google or Baidu or something like that. But it's not really like asking the question in the way it would be phrased, because you just still don't really understand the pieces that make up those queries and their relationships to one another. Okay? So what we refer to here is the web of linked documents. Typically, we know it's just a bunch of HTML pages and maybe some APIs that are coming from applications, maybe using something like XML. But they're all untyped links, which basically means every link, effectively, it means that every link is comparable to every other link. It doesn't say anything about what that link is serving. And then you've got a bunch of these that are connected to databases. And these databases perhaps might be, as it were, the places where this content is stored. So that's pretty much the model for the old web, the web of linked documents. So one thing, one analog or metaphor that people like to use is this idea of silos of data on the web. So basically, rather than thinking about a web server as just simply being a collection of pages, let's think about web pages and things, content on web servers, as just being collections of data, and sort of forget about the pages that these are embedded in. Just think about, as it were, focus on the data that is on each one of these. And think of it, once again, like just a storage space that accumulates all of this data in whatever form it might be. Okay? And in that case, basically, in that way, you really don't necessarily have the interaction between them. So effectively, data silos on the web could be sort of independent, because it's not really sort of showing any links between them. Now clearly that's not going to be terribly meaningful when you try to do something outside of one particular silo. But still, it's a meaningful metaphor when you think about the organization of that data. Okay, now along came this idea about open data. Okay, and the idea for open data was the fact that it was in each of these silos, but a mechanism could be provided to make it interoperable and easy to use. And also with that data was metadata, which gave some description about how individuals could understand it or parse that data, or how machines could understand a little bit about that data. And there were a number of common open formats that used open free standards, non-proprietary standards, that actually then helped people do that integration. And the idea that, once again, is that within the domain of these data silos, then it would be easy to have applications that could have meaningful effects, that it could actually do particular kinds of applications. All right? And I'll give an example about that in just a second. But the basic idea, too, behind open data, and remember, bear in mind, this is not necessarily related, as it were, to data that's on the web, is the idea is that anybody could publish it, anybody could decide that they want to make their data open to the public, you know, as long as it's not proprietary secrets, as long as it's not government secrets, as long as it's not personal data. You wouldn't want to make, say, payrolls obvious, you know, open to everybody. So individuals could publish open data. Companies and institutions could publish it, and governments could do it. And then there's the list of whoever could use it. Anybody could use it, because it was basically saying this data is uncontrolled. Anybody has access to it who can find a reasonable need for it. And so what you wound up in that case is, here's the U.S. government's open data project, data.gov, which basically now says that the U.S. government is making data in all of these particular areas open to anybody who wants to use it. Okay? So if you want, in that particular case, to do some kind of study, say, on agriculture, then in fact you are able to have access to that data free of charge. Okay? But it's going to be up to you. In fact, this is just a silo. It's going to be up to you to take that data in whatever format it happens to have been published by the companies or the departments, as it were, that provided that data. Okay? There's certainly a big move amongst governments to basically have open data, part of a policy, as it were, of transparency that became, you know, very fashionable at the time. And so what that basically meant is, with all these repositories of open data, that you could effectively had the potential of having a worldwide network of data silos that you could connect. And so not only could you potentially get information, say, from the U.S. government, but maybe certainly the UK has been very active in open data. So once again, the possibilities of how you could use it became, you know, very significant. But it was still, in effect, unstructured data, because it was really however the person who created and published the data chose, whatever format they chose to provide it in. So along comes this idea of using the web to manage this data, of really using web technologies to, in effect, make access to these open data repositories and the content within them, you know, far more accessible. And this particular scheme was from Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web. So basically, he did it in terms of rating by stars. So the idea is, if you were a provider of data, if you made your content available on the web, which wasn't really required in terms of your data silos, if you made it available on the web, and it didn't matter which format you made it available on the web in, then you get one star. If you made your content available as structured data, and we're going to see what that means in just a second, basically trying to come up with some common scheme that could be used between data sets, you got two stars. If you used a non-proprietary data format, incidentally, I could say here is that for structured data, that could be proprietary format. So, for example, you could say you would get two stars if you published openly your Excel spreadsheets. But Excel is not an open format. So if you use a non-proprietary format, right, which would then exclude Excel, then you got three stars. You would get four stars if, in fact, then you would take your data, and this is where you start using web technology, take your data and use URLs to identify items of data. Then you would get four stars. You would get five stars if, in fact, then you took this data that you had linked to using URLs and provided the capability of linking it with other data. So in other words, now we're using URLs not to just to point to pages or applications. We're using URLs to point to data. So what happens when data points to data? Effectively, logically, it is a merger of those data sets. Or there's a relationship between those data sets. Okay? So that was the particular idea for linked open data. Taking open data and then adding these particular features, which then made it directly addressable via web technology. And so that basically said, okay, if you've got a web of linked data, not just a web of data like we had before, then the analogy there, since it's linked, is that no longer is it just a global data store, it's a global database because you can search through it. So all of these silos now become searchable almost as though they were all part of a distributed database system. It also means that rather than you having to interpret the relationships, that some of these processes could then be understood by machines. This is basically with the understanding now that certainly a lot of this data that can be on the web could be used in processes, right? So imagine, if you will, a software application, the input of which is just data that's streaming in from the web. Okay? Well, clearly the data that's coming into that software application has to be structured in such a way that that software application can understand it and doesn't require the intervention of a human trying to interpret what those results mean. Your primary objects are going to be things or descriptions of things, and the links are going to be between things. The links aren't going to be between pages the way it was in the past. And there was a great deal of structure in this description, by definition, what it tried to do, and a great deal of explicit semantics, which once again would be critical in terms of how a process could understand it. So back to that particular idea, it would say, if I did a search and said, what is the capital of China, right, then the process would understand exactly what capital means, right, and it would understand that China is a country, and it would understand that a capital with respect to a country has a particular meaning. So consequently, it could derive effectively a unique answer. You know, because it really understood the context of that question and the elements that compose that question. Right? So all of a sudden, what you've done is you've taken these little separate facts, which is why you got so many responses when you did the search. You've taken all these separate facts and logically put them together in context and created a pseudo form of knowledge, because it says, now I know what capital of China means, and that's Beijing. Okay? And so the scenario becomes something like this. So you're not linking documents, you're linking data, you're linking objects. And so consequently then, these links that you have between them, defined by URLs, actually have a meaning, because now they show a relationship. They have associated with them a relationship. Like in that previous example, a country has a capital. Right? So there is a relationship between China and Beijing that is very explicit. It's not just a link from China to Beijing, which absolutely could have no meaning whatsoever. Right? Okay, so basically here, imagine this idea where you could have a web where documents are available for download, right? But there's no hyperlinks between them. You know, how are you going to access that kind of data? You don't have hyperlinks between documents. But basically what you have is hyperlinks between... It's not even fair to say hyperlinks, because hyperlinks to some extent sort of assume the use by a human. You have links between objects that show relationships. Okay? And that kind of thing is true. It already happens. One big community that's very interested in merging data is bioinformatics. So effectively what you see in some of these fields is that they're like these silos. They've got all this collective information, but it's hard to get into it, and it's hard to associate it with other comparable information. So it's hard for researchers in the same areas to share data and learn what the other ones are doing. Okay? But data on the web, which I referred to as OneStar, that puts your data on the web, data on the web is not enough. Because that really doesn't define any sort of infrastructure. Okay? So effectively what you need to do is have data that's integrated over the web. And that's where a lot of these, I haven't used this term before, these semantic web type technologies come from. If anybody's wondered, what's the state of the semantic web? Is the semantic web still alive? Yeah, it's alive and well. But it's taking, one of the forms that it's taking is this idea of linked data. Okay? So just putting data on the web is not enough. But it's better than nothing, because it basically says is if you put your data on the web, then you can read it, you can print it, you can store it, you can export it to another system. You can modify it, and you can share it with conditions. When I say with conditions, I can say, I can share this, but it's an Excel database, so you better figure out, you know, you better have some means to process Excel. Or it's a Microsoft Word document, and if you don't have some way of reading Microsoft Word, then too bad. Okay, so you can in fact still share it with respect to the web, but that's not enough. But it's better than nothing. At least it's putting it on the web and it's pointing URLs at it. Okay, what about two stars? Well, the idea with two stars, if you think about where that star system was, if I had two screens I could put that up in that way, is it's everything that you might have if you have one star, that's where you just put it on the web, but it's basically saying is that now with two stars, you can in fact directly process it in such a way that you can combine it with other data, or you can run programs to do such things as visualizations or other kinds of calculations and those things. Or you can perhaps export it into another structured format. You know, once again, that's an improvement because it's an improvement over just the notion of putting it only on the web. But it's still not good enough. Okay, what about three stars? In the case of three stars, when you are taking proprietary formats out of the picture, it is basically saying you've got everything that you had with two stars, but now since you don't have any proprietary formats, you've got open formats and open standards, that means that you can manipulate the data in any way without software restrictions. I'm going to share this data with you. And it might be spreadsheet data, but it is not expressed in a proprietary format. You can use it with any kind of thing. So, for example, it could be comma-delimited data. That's unstructured, it's open, it's well-defined. Okay? And you can manipulate it without necessarily any restrictions in terms of the tools that you use. That's three stars. Okay, with four stars... basically says now everything you can do with three, but we're building up to this big picture clearly, but now you can link to it from anywhere because it's got a URI or URL. That means that you can bookmark it. That means that you can reuse parts of it, so you can do these mashups that you used to like to see, because you can uniquely identify segments just like you did in mashups in Web 2.0. So that means you can combine it with other data, but you still have complete control over the data and can optimize its access. And it also means that since it's in this open format with URLs, that other people who have data can also use it. Okay? When you get to five stars, it basically, the presumption is that now you can understand more related data. In other words, you can look at data that is also published in this format that perhaps in some ways has a logical or contextual connection with your data, and so consequently can give your data set more value. Okay, so you can learn about the schemes. It can make your data discoverable in terms of that means other people are able to find it. And as I said, you increase the value of your data. Now, that said, if you believe in this model, you know, where do you want to be? You want to be have five stars. Who wouldn't want to have five stars? Okay, in this case. If you're intent on sharing your data, or perhaps in that way turning your data into what could be perceived as knowledge. Okay, so the idea, as we said with linked data, it's still web technology, so the idea here is that, okay, you're going to use URIs. URIs and URLs are basically the same thing, even though URI is a higher order. You can use URIs as the name of things, not just documents, and you're not your home page, like you might be in the other case. And this can apply for any kind of data. You also use HTTP, so all of these things that you know how to use for the web, basically all the protocols that are associated with the web, like URLs and HTTP, still apply. Because clearly now there's a great deal of tools that already use this. Okay? So that means then with URLs that you can have globally unique names, because clearly every URL has to be unique, right? Otherwise, you know, you're not ever going to have a URL that's pointing, you know, to multiple things, the same URL. And so it's going to be able to allow people to look up that data, not just pages, look up that data by means of the URLs. You provide useful information in RDF. This is the catch. This is the catch. This is what makes it happen. This is actually the hard part. Resource description format. So we're going to talk about that. Really what that does, because that is the element of linked open data and any of the semantic technologies which really gives them the contextual power that we've talked about. And so that means that when someone looks at up something with a URI, that in fact they're getting a description, not just of data, but they're getting a description of that data in RDF. And I'll show you what that means. Okay? RDF is simply an instance of XML, which means, once again, it's open. Okay? But it's specifically, as we talked about, what you want to have with the relationship with objects, it is specifically a format to show relationships between objects. And to show relationships in a structured way that they can be easily traversed by machines or by processes, just in the same way as you're able easily with a process to go down a hierarchical tree, you can follow the paths that exist in an RDF document. That's what RDF is. Okay, so here's an example. Here's what's on the Ecom ICOM website about the classes that are currently being offered and the schedule that's currently going. Okay, this is very useful, right? But if you look at this, this is only designed for humans. This is unstructured. The only way you understand the relationships in this table is because you're familiar with the format and you can basically seeing the explicit from your experience. You know, you know what columns and rows and tables mean. Okay? Machines aren't that clever in that sense. Relationships are far more complex than that. Okay? So it would be very hard, as it were, to think about building an application that somehow tried to extract the information that's in this table and use it in a meaningful way. Right? In other words, something other than viewing by humans. Okay, this is what RDF does. RDF basically says, let's take each of these elements and show their relationship with one another. So effectively, this would be just a piece of perhaps the relationships that's in that table. And we can say that Ecom ICOM organizes Ecom 6013. That's the course I'm happen to be doing now. Okay? And Ecom 6013 has a relationship, for example, with two other objects, probably even more objects, which effectively says, okay, Ecom 6013 starts at this particular date and takes place in Hong Kong. Now, these relationships are very well understood because they're part of an ontology. Okay? So that means that these are referred to as RDF triples. Right? So if you think of them done in this particular way, then you can once again look at this triple and saying it defines the relationship between Ecom ICOM, Ecom 6013, and some details about Ecom 6013. Alright? Now, there's a little ringer in here for this, because you see this XSD.date. Because to the first order, you could say, well, a machine is going to look at that and it's going to realize, well, you know, different places give dates in different ways. Right? Some do month, day, year. Some say day, month, year. Probably some that say year, month, day, or any of those things. So effectively, what I'm defining here is another description or another ontology, which effectively is defining the kind of date format that I'm going to use. So that's the expectation. That's the expectation of how to interpret that data. Okay? So now you would say, okay, when someone goes to the Ecom ICOM website, that they get the content about these classes. Now, in the middle of this request that comes once again over the web, there's going to be a reference to this RDF, you know, through content negotiation. Content negotiation on the web is exactly the same thing where the web server and the web browser realizes this is a picture, this is an image, right? So that's why you don't get a web page that has this whole mass of binary data that a picture would be if it was interpreted literally, because it says don't interpret this as anything except as a picture. It's going to pull down this RDF description, and so therefore when it gets the data from Ecom ICOM, it knows then what the relationships between those data elements are. Right? So all of a sudden I've made some of the information that's in that table far more intelligible. You know, so now I could actually go on there and say something like, what Ecom ICOM class starts on the 10th of September? You wouldn't be able to make a query like that if all you were using was that table. Okay? So you can really see the power behind using these kinds of tools to create what I would contend here is knowledge out of these little individual desperate pieces of data. Okay? So why publish linked data? So why would you want to be a 5-star? Because effectively it is making that data more discoverable, therefore more usable by others. Once you understand this idea of how to process RDF and the open source free engines for doing that, you know, it's easy to consume. It also means that you can reduce redundancy, because once again, if you're sharing data, that means that, you know, the critical data might only don't have to be replicated. It can only be in one location. And you give it added value. In other words, your data now, you effectively become the subject matter expert, as it were, of your data, which gives it value. Okay? So how do you publish linked open data? Effectively, what you do is you identify the data, just like the open data, the data that you want to make available to everybody. You clean it up, whatever that means. Simply now, that's the recognition that you're not the only one that's going to be using it. So you might want to eliminate that step because your data is probably already clean. You model your data. You know, in other words, think about the vocabularies or those relationships that exist between the data. Now, some of that actually is already there, because the idea of these relationships, you know, as you can see, is very similar to this idea of what you might have in a relational database. So you may have field names and all those things that really show, you know, what the definition of those objects are, not necessarily the relationships between them. You select and specify your license. Now, what does that mean? That basically says, look, you know, you are effectively taking your data set and making it available to anybody in the world. Okay? So what are the conditions under which you are licensing this data? You know, something like Creative Commons, saying, okay, you're free to use my data, but I don't want you going off making a lot of money with it. Okay, something of that nature. You convert it to RDF, link it to other data, publish it and promote it, and when others start using it, boom, you become five star. That's the process. Okay? As far as consuming it, basically it says, consider now the data sets that you have available with you. It's only then going to be an issue of creativity about how people can use that data. You know, you're already seeing this in the case of mashups. When somebody says, okay, I've got map data over here, and I've got data coming from the police over here, we put them together, and it has more meaning. It really says something different that perhaps wasn't there before. Or you have data coming from the police, and you have weather data, and you put them together and say, there's less crime when it's raining. You can prove it. You might think that implicitly, but now you can prove it. Okay? So you can evaluate your data sets, once again deal with licensing, create the way that you're going to use this data, you know, the way it's going to be cached or uploaded, and then create applications. And when you're creating these applications, it's basically now it is saying that you are creating a relationship that it can exist between you and the publishers of the data that you are linking to. So all of a sudden, with this particular model, all these, what used to be independent data sets, these independent silos, have some way of connecting with one another. Okay? So I said data.gov. You know, is open data from the U.S. government. Well, it's not only that now, is that what data.gov now is providing this open data in RDF. So that's just an example of one of these other silos. So if someone could think of some clever way to take my RDF statements for Ecom Icom and hook it up with data in the U.S. government, you'd be able to do it, if it could possibly make any sense. Okay? So that says that data.gov has gone the next step between just making open data available, but now making linked open data available. Okay? And there's actually a project, as it were. You know, for all these people, as it were, who have these linked open data sets, and how, in fact, those data sets can interoperate with one another. So as a community, you know, it's in a community that it basically says, we are going to be creating these libraries of data, but that data is going to be in RDF, as RDF triples. Okay? I know this is impossible to read, but this is an example of what's referred to as the linked open data cloud. Okay? And all of these are representing data sets that you would have that you could have access to. In other words, you could integrate your work with, and you can actually then, as you publish, you become a part of this cloud. And at last point, it was like over 180 data sets with 20 billion, over in excess of 20 billion RDF triples. Now, there's a very interesting thing about this particular slide, which you probably can't read. Right in the center, you wonder, what is this? What is that right in the middle? Well, if you're talking about turning data into knowledge, you know, what is one of the most widely used sources of reference information on the web? Wikipedia, right? Everybody uses Wikipedia. Well, what you see in the middle of this, you can't really see it. What is in the middle of this is what is called DBpedia, which effectively is taking all of the content that's in Wikipedia and putting it in RDF. Now imagine the value of something like that, which effectively says is that now all of your data can directly link to references in Wikipedia, but not only that, but all language versions of Wikipedia. That's an incredibly powerful thing, because effectively if you're trying to relate something, turning your data into knowledge, what's going to be a better reference source than what you might see in Wikipedia? Okay? So that's DBpedia. Okay? And it's free. You have access to it. How do you access data in it? With URLs. Right? That's all you need. And just like we said, any of these particular schemes are still using URLs, are still using those same elements of web technology. Okay? All right, now, let me show you. Here's the DBpedia. What part of the DBpedia entry on Slack? You know, which is where I am. Okay? So effectively what you have in this is that it really defines in that way all of the descriptions about the laboratory as linked open data. And if you see this, at least this particular part of it, not only does it have the descriptions, but here it is in French. Right? Here it is in German, and I'm not really sure what that language is. But it's in multiple languages. Effectively now, because once again, there's no pretense that everybody has to use English. Right? So, why do I use that as a description? It's because another example that I have for you is here's a paper that we recently did with a student of mine. And basically what we were doing is there's a project that collects what is called pinger data. You know, basically this is like the ping command, the internet, the TCP/IP or TCP/IP, which basically, you know, you send a little short message to another site just to see if that site is alive or to see what route it takes. And what this effectively done is collects pinger data. You know, how long it takes to get from one site to another site, what route it takes, etc. Whether or not it drops off, disappears. Okay? And it takes this data, which you can imagine is a pretty big data set. It takes this data and puts it in linked open data format. Now, the reason I had the other example is, of course, you would expect now that somewhere in that linked open data, the description of the pinger data, there's going to be a reference to Slack, because that's where it comes from. Well, look, I don't have to define what Slack is. All I have to do is point to the DBpedia definition of Slack, and boom, there it is. I don't have to reinvent anything. I don't have to create any data. And whenever it's changed, that change gets migrated. So it's very easy to do that. So here's an example, as it were, of taking this data. Triplification says converting it to RDF. Now, think about it in that sense. So we've got this big data set of pinger data. Right? Who's going to be interested in something like that? Well, who might be interested in that data and think about how they might mash it up with other data? Well, people that are interested in analyzing performance on the internet. They could use it. and certainly probably use it in ways that was never intended when that data was collected. You would think that telecoms would be interested in it because they're the guys who own the wires. They'd be interested in that data. Right? They could use it with respect to some of the analysis that they do. You would think that IT managers might be interested in using it. Because if you're one of the sites that's getting pinged and you got a pretty poor response, that means the world knows that you're not necessarily doing something right. Okay? Digital divide, quality of service could use it. Right? In the sense that if you're thinking about education, don't you want to be sure that the pipe that you send the video to, people at the other end are capable of seeing it? The bandwidth is good enough. Emergency services, et cetera, et cetera. And in that way, you could say any of these parties might be interested in the pinger data, but it also gives them the opportunity to take that data and merge it with their own data and use it in any creative ways that they can to build knowledge. Okay. So the power of linked open data is basically now saying that with this particular model, you effectively can do web-scale publishing of data. Everything is a potential resource. Anything that collects data is a potential resource as long as it is in linked open data format. Everything can be annotated. It's easy to extend it, so it's easy to put different relationships, add additional relationships. Easy to merge RDF graphs and data ontologies. Okay? People often are afraid of ontologies. Only people who really love ontologies are librarians. You know, they're the ones who know how to use them. Hope that doesn't offend anybody in here. But basically the notion too is that you wouldn't have to invent ontologies, because already vocabularies and ontologies probably exist for the kind of thing that you're doing. And reuse, we talked about, and being able to do complex querying. Okay? So that means that something like with Pinger, what we can do is say, okay, what is the average RTT, round trip time, between Slack and the University of Malaysia? You think you're going to be able to get that from Google? You think Google's going to even understand what you're talking about when you ask a question like that? Okay? So, why is linked open data important? Well, it's part of it's back to this idea about open data, because in many cases, it's our data. Okay? That's why it's important. Of course, our data is important. We talked about how it can reduce redundancy. It promotes this idea of a digital society, collaboration, people doing it. Data innovation and discovery. And it holds the promise, like we saw in that pyramid, of taking all this unstructured data that we might have had on the web and turning it to knowledge, and maybe somebody can figure out how to turn it into wisdom. And the end result, like part of the dream for the web, is it's going to benefit everybody. So, thank you very much. And if you're curious, that's my Chinese name and my Chinese domain.
Is that right?
You're asking me how to pronounce it, Paul? Really? Are you serious? Okay. I might say make one comment too. Is anybody? I noticed a bunch of people taking photos for this. You're welcome to these slides.
You didn't even charge for it.
No. Anybody who wants copies of these slides, you're welcome to them. Just let me know.
Great. Thanks very much.
Yeah.